The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Kate Kopp, and I am the social media manager for the Free Library. I must admit, I have a page from one of our speakers' books framed and hanging on my wall at home, so I'm very honored to be up here introducing him to you tonight. Chuck Klosterman is a pop culture journalist and New York Times bestselling author of 6 books of nonfiction, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and I Wear the Black Hat, in addition to 2 novels, Downtown Al and The Visible Man. His debut book, Fargo Rock City, was a winner of the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award, which recognizes books, articles, and recording liner notes on the subject of music. In addition to his books, he has written extensively for GQ, Esquire, Spin, The Washington Post, The New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, and The AV Club. He currently covers sports and pop culture for ESPN. His new book, But What If We're Wrong, examines what our contemporary world will look like to those who perceive it as the past. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Chuck Klosterman.
Hello. Thanks. Hey, thanks for coming and responding to my hello. Instead of being silent, that would have been very awkward. What she just described, besides being very nice, is also true. I am here promoting this book, and it does exactly what she says. It is essentially an attempt to think about the contemporary world, the way we look, for the most part, at history. There's a way that we look at our day-to-day life, and we see it as very fluid and transient, and opinions kind of go up and down in little spikes, and there's a sense that we're kind of almost living in a continual sense of chaos. But when we think about, say, the mid-16th century or even the early 20th century, we tend to have these very kind of defined, kind of iconic views of what those periods were about. And the process that we go about to come up with those ideas seems to be based on, logic and rational thought and merit and all of these different things, where I think in reality it probably has much more to do with sort of arbitrary reasons that really reflect how any period of time decides this is the way we're supposed to think about history. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the very beginning of this book, just the very front, not too much. I never read too much in readings because I am aware that it's the dullest part of these things. I know you're not really supposed to say that. You're at a book reading. I'm the author. I'm supposed to say this is a really important thing, but it is boring to watch a man read. Unless you're 3 and it's like Go Dog Go or something, you know? What? Especially if you're deaf. Well, I got to admit, how many deaf people are there in the audience? Okay, good. There's nobody up here signing along, you know? Although it would be cool if there was. Every once in a while, you'll go to a rock concert or a hip-hop show, and they'll have someone signing along the stage. I went to a Public Enemy show where that happened. It was amazing. The entire audience was just transfixed on this white woman signing while, like, Chuck D and Flavor Flav were running around, like, throwing fruit. They were throwing fruit into the audience, and people were like, look at that woman. but regardless, okay. I'm going to read the beginning of this book. Well, it kind of gives, a general idea of what it's about. Then I'll kind of talk a little bit more. And then for the most part, I'm hoping that you can, have questions. And you don't have to ask questions about the book. I know sometimes you go to an event like this, you feel like, well, okay, we're in the library, this person is coming, they're representing this book, I need to ask about the craft of writing. You can do that if you want, but you can ask about anything. A lot of times at readings, people try to out-weird me. Like, they know I'm weird, so they're like, I'm going to out-weird this person. One time I was in Minneapolis, and it was actually about the craft of writing. That was the whole idea of the event. And some girl on the balcony said, would you rather have hair for fingernails or fingernails for hair? You know? And my first reaction is like, well, it's kind of dumb, but at the same time, it's interesting. Because if I have hair for fingernails, I'm like a limited werewolf. But if I have fingernails for hair, I'm a human rhino. So it was a great question. Okay, let's go. I've spent most of my life being wrong. Not about everything, just about most things. I mean, sometimes I get stuff right. I married the right person. I've never purchased life insurance as an investment. The first time undrafted free agent Tony Romo led a touchdown drive against the Giants on Monday Night Football, I told my roommate, I think this guy will have a decent career. At a New Year's Eve party in 2008, I predicted Michael Jackson would unexpectedly die within the next 12 months. An anecdote I shall casually recount at every New Year's Eve party I'll ever attend for the rest of my life. Okay, I'm obviously not happy Michael Jackson died. He was a genius. You know, it's a tragedy. But it's pretty amazing I did this. I still can't believe it. It was a New Year's Eve party. We were passing around a sheet of paper, and everyone was making predictions for the next year. And some people were trying to be funny, and some people were trying to be serious. And I said Michael Jackson would die unexpectedly, and there would be issues over his estate. And then that summer, it happened. Now, I was not happy Michael Jackson died. But I emailed a lot of people that day. But these are the exceptions. It's far, far easier for me to catalog the various things I've been wrong about. My insistence that I would never own a cell phone. The time I wagered $100 against $1 that Barack Obama would never become president or even receive the Democratic nomination. My three-week obsession over the looming Y2K crisis, prompting me to hide bundles of cash, bottled water, and Oreo cookies throughout my one-bedroom apartment. At this point, my wrongness doesn't even surprise me. I almost anticipate it. Whenever people tell me I'm wrong about something, I might disagree with them in conversation, but in my mind, I assume their accusation is justified, even if I'm relatively certain they're wrong too. Yet these failures are the small potatoes. These micro moments of wrongness are personal. I assumed the answer to something was A, but the true answer was B or C or D. Reasonable parties can disagree about the unknowable, and the passage of time slowly proves one party to be slightly more reasonable than the other. The stakes are low. If I'm wrong about something specific, it's usually my own fault, and someone else is usually, but not totally, correct. But what about the things we're all wrong about? What about ideas that are so accepted and internalized that we're not even in a position to question their fallibility? These are ideas so ingrained in the collective consciousness that it seems foolhardy to even wonder if they're potentially untrue. Sometimes these seem like questions only a child would ask, since children aren't paralyzed by the pressures of consensus or common sense. It's a dissonance that creates the most unavoidable of intellectual paradoxes. When you ask smart people if they believe there are major ideas currently accepted by the culture at large that will eventually be proven false, they will say, well, of course, there must be. This phenomenon has been experienced by every generation who's ever lived since the dawn of human history. Yet offer those same people a laundry list of contemporary ideas that might fit that description, and they'll be tempted to reject them all. Great example. If I went to anybody in this audience and I said, so do you think somebody we currently consider to be a great president will one day be seen as a problematic president or a failed president, and that the idea about a great president will change? This person here is just nodding yes. Okay, what if I said, okay, it's Lincoln. See, everyone's like, you're crazy. It's whenever you give people ideas in the abstract that our ideas might be wrong, they go, of course, that's common sense. And yet give them specific answers, and they just bristle. I started doing this project, okay? I started doing this book project where, for the most part, and I'm talking in many different disciplines. I talk about literature. I talk about rock music. I talk about science, television, football, politics, all these different things. And what I would do is I would go to experts in the field, and I would say, hey, like, I'm not trying to contradict your view of reality, because your view of reality is probably mine. We probably share the same view in reality. But I'm just curious, what's the possibility in your mind that these ingrained ideas could be false? One of the people I went to was a guy named Brian Greene, who's kind of like a rock star physicist at Columbia. He was on an episode of Big Bang Theory. He's a big string theory guy. So I'm going to him to talk about sort of ideas in science, and I'm framing it like this. Like, I'm not trying to contradict your ideas. I'm just saying, like, is there any part of your mind that questions this? And then to be safe, I go like, well, because there's some things I know that, like, aren't on the table. Like, our understanding of gravity is stable. And then he was like, no, it's not. Like, in 500 years, it might be totally different. It might be seen as not the force that drives the universe, but just a force that we can sense, like a secondary tangential sensation. He compared it to temperature. Like, if you put your arm underneath one of these hot lights, you'll feel the sensation of temperature. But temperature isn't real. Molecules are moving faster. The thing we feel seems like temperature. That's how we describe it. And he said it's possible that someday we may realize that gravity is just the force that we can recognize, that we can see sort of, you know, things fall from the sky or whatever, you know. But there's something behind that that's making it happen. Gravity is just the visible part. And I thought to myself, this book might work. If the example I'm using is the unchangeable thing is changeable, then kind of everything is up for grabs. And, you know, it's an interesting deal. Prior to the 1600s, like prior to Isaac Newton, the idea of gravity was pretty much universally believed to be the principle that Aristotle, the philosopher, had put forth. And Aristotle's idea was that the reason a rock doesn't float is because a rock wants to be on the ground. Like, a rock longs to be at the center of the universe, and of course, Earth must be the center of the universe, they believed, and the center of the Earth is the dead center of the universe. So if you drop a rock, it wants to get to the center of the universe, which is the center of the Earth, and the ground stops it, but that's where it wants to be. Now, of course, that seems absurd when I say it now, but for 2,000 years, this is what we thought. And this kind of brings forth a whole bunch of, to me, very interesting questions. One, if mankind could believe something false was objectively true for 2,000 years, why do we reflexively assume that our current understanding of gravity, which we've embraced for a mere 350 years, will somehow exist forever? Two, is it possible that this type of problem has simply been solved? In other words, maybe this isn't a continuum, maybe we're at the end. What if Newton's answer really is, more or less, the final answer, and the only one we will ever need? Because if that's true, it would mean we're at the end of a process that has defined the experience of being alive. It would mean certain intellectual quests would no longer be necessary. And that sort of changes the meaning of being an intellectually curious person. Three, which statement is more reasonable to make? I believe gravity exists, or I'm 99.9% sure gravity exists. Certainly, the second statement is safer. But if we're going to acknowledge even the slightest possibility of being wrong about gravity, we're pretty much giving up on the possibility of being right about anything at all. One of the books I read when I was writing this was a book called Being Wrong. It was written by a woman named Catherine Schultz. She's now most famous. She recently won a Pulitzer Prize, in fact, for a story she did about a potential earthquake that's going to happen in the Pacific Northwest. This was in The New Yorker. And basically, it's going to be this cataclysmic event. If it ever occurs, there'll be a tsunami, pretty much Seattle and Portland, poof, into the ocean. You know. But her book was a little different. Her book was about specific wrongness. You know, mine's book's about collective wrongness. But nonetheless, She spends a few pages on the concept of naive realism. Now, Schultz notes that while there are few conscious proponents of naive realism, that doesn't mean there are no naive realists. I would go a step further than her. I suspect most conventionally intelligent people are naive realists, and I think it might be the defining intellectual quality of this era. Now, the straightforward definition of naive realism doesn't seem that outlandish. It's a theory that suggests the world is exactly as it appears. A two-year-old is a naive realist. If you put, like, a baseball on the stage and you have a two-year-old kid and you say, like, where's the baseball? He'll, like, go there. And then you put a bucket on the baseball and say, like, where's the baseball? And he'll be like, it's gone. Like, if he can't see it, you have to usually be about three or four years old before you can understand that just because something isn't visible doesn't mean it's gone. So that's like kind of like the scientific, biological definition of naive realism. And that you can see how that could create the possibility for, like, colossal wrongness. You know, the sun appears to be moving across the sky, so therefore the sun must be orbiting the earth or whatever. But my personal characterization of naive realism is wider and maybe a little more insidious. I think it operates as the manifestation of two ingrained beliefs. Okay, the first is that someone says, when considering any question, I must be rational and logical to the point of dismissing any unverifiable data as preposterous. In other words, when I look at a problem, I want to be strictly what the statistics say, what the facts tell us. Anything else is just conjecture and attempt to mislead us. I am hardwired to only see what is logically and rationally there. And then the second statement, which is somehow connected, when considering any question, I'm going to unconsciously assume that the information we currently have is all the information that will ever be available. So I'm really strict, a smart person will often be like, I'm really sticking to the facts on this. Everything else is just subjective. But I'm also going to behave like this is all the information there will ever be, that what I'm dealing with is limited, and that today we are at the finite point of our understanding of whatever the topic is. This is a problem, okay? Here's an extreme example, the possibility of life after death. When considered rationally, there is no justification for believing that anything happens to anyone upon the moment of his or her death. There is no reasonable counter to the prospect of nothingness. Any anecdotal story about, like, floating to a white light, or like Shirley MacLaine saying she lived on Atlantis, or like the little book about the boy who's like went to a coma and came out and he was like, I met God, he's great, or whatever, you know. These are automatically and justifiably dismissed by any secular intellectual. Yet this wholly logical position discounts the overwhelming likelihood that we currently don't know something critical about the experience of life, much less the ultimate conclusion to that experience. There are so many things we don't know about energy, or the way energy is transferred, or why energy, which can't be created or destroyed, exists at all. We can't truly conceive of the conditions of a multidimensional reality, even though we're probably already living inside a multidimensional reality. We have a limited understanding of consciousness. We have a limited understanding of time, and of the perception of time, and of the possibility that all time is happening at once. So while it seems unrealistic to seriously consider the prospect of life after death, it seems equally naive to assume that our contemporary understanding of this phenomenon is remotely complete. We have no idea what we don't know, or what we'll eventually learn, or what might be true despite our perpetual inability to comprehend what that truth is. It's impossible to understand the world of today until today has become tomorrow. Now, this is no brilliant insight, and only a fool would disagree, but it's remarkable how habitually this truth is ignored. We constantly pretend our perception of the present day will not seem ludicrous in retrospect, simply because there doesn't appear to be any other option. But there is another option, and the option is this. We must start from the premise that, in all likelihood, we are already wrong. And not wrong in the sense that we are examining questions and coming to incorrect conclusions, because most of our conclusions are reasonable and coherent. The problem is with the questions themselves. So what this book is then, in both subjective things like art and objective things like science, math, some things of that nature, history, although history is kind of a weird in-between thing, I sort of deal with this idea that what do we sort of sense is the truth of our reality, and if that is wrong, what are alternative possibilities that people in a distant future will see or understand or claim? Basically, it's sort of like if we think about how we imagine life was, say, during the Civil War. Everybody in here has kind of an idea of what it must have been like to live, say, in Philadelphia during the Civil War. Whatever we think is probably inaccurate. We have no better answer, but it probably is. So the question becomes, well, what are we doing wrong? How are we looking at things incorrectly? I'm trying to do that with this idea of people in the future, people who have not yet been born, looking back at this period now. So with that in mind, let us begin taking questions, if there are questions. I hope there are. Otherwise, I'm really going to have to stall. Here's a guy. Okay, he's asking about the British woman who narrated the audiobook. Okay. This is my 9th book, okay? When you live in public, if you do, I mean, I've been very fortunate. I've had a degree of notoriety. I've had success. I've made money. All these things have happened. But in today's modern world, there is also the internet, which tells you how people perceive you. And a lot of people hate my voice. Now, I hate my voice, but most of you do too, your own voice, if you hear it on tape. But I realized that a mistake I made, and I shouldn't even say this is a mistake, because in some ways it's really helped, but, you know, I used to do all my own audiobooks and you know, I've been on a lot of podcasts. I go on the radio all the time. I was like on ESPN for a while. And I realized that I had made a mistake. The one thing that, you know, I'm not the greatest writer in the world, but I have one quality as a writer, that my writing has a natural voice to it. And that's a hard thing to make up. And that's, I'm not saying like I'm awesome. It just happened. I never tried. But when people read my work, there's a voice to it, and voice is the hardest thing to create or manufacture. But by doing all this public speaking, people now actually hear my voice. What they used to do is imagine a voice, and if you don't know what a writer actually sounds like, but you like the writing and you like the voice you imagine is the best version of yourself. But now people hear me sometimes, and they don't like my voice, and it changes the way they consume my writing. So I was like, do I want to read the audiobook for this? For one thing, it's a boring process. To read your own book aloud, it takes a whole bunch of hours. You get paid $4,000, which is nothing to sneeze at, but come on, I can make $4,000 other ways, in a way that I don't hate. And I thought to myself, who do I like to listen to? I like to listen to British women. If I'm in a situation where I'm talking to a British woman, I'm happy. If I go to a bar and the bartender is a British woman, I'm going to be at that bar a long time. So I said when they asked me to do this, I was like, let's get a British woman to do this. And to my surprise, they were like, that's hilarious. I thought they would say, that's insane, but they said, that's hilarious. So I was like, great. So if you buy the audio version of this book, I read the first part of the book and the very end of the book. The middle is all this British woman. Seemed like a good idea to me.
You know, you've been talking about how we often think we know more than we do, and we might be wrong, we're probably wrong. The question I had is on dozens of issues, I won't list them. Even when you tell people, this is the evidence, you know, what you believe is demonstrably wrong, people don't want to accept it. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you think that is.
Well, That's a complicated question. You're saying if you show somebody things that you would say is irrefutable, that they don't accept it. Well, it's a couple things, okay? One thing that has happened to society since really the beginning of intellectual discourse, I don't mean like this, I mean since from the beginning of people kind of talking about ideas, is a separation between intellect and emotion. In fact, if somebody says, you know, this guy or this woman broke my heart, you actually feel it in your heart. Like, we've managed to convince ourselves that heartbreak feels bad in your body, or you feel your stomach drop when you hear bad news or whatever. And yet all these emotions that seem separate from thoughts are thoughts. They are coming from your mind, okay? Thoughts and emotions are much closer than we like to admit. We like to see them as separate things. We like to accuse people in arguments of you're arguing emotionally, which means you're losing the argument or whatever. But because these things are tied together and we can consciously separate them, it doesn't mean that we're actually separating them in practice. So when somebody disagrees with seeming evidence, it seems like they're going, well, you know, I'm making an intellectual argument and you're intellectually contradicting it. They're actually emotionally contradicting it. But part of the reason the evidence seems so true to you is also emotional. I mean, you go back over, I mean, the history of ideas, and in some, I mean, okay, that's a high-minded way of saying what this book is. I mean, I don't know if anybody would read that book and read this book and go like, this was about the history of ideas, but it was really what it is. And the history of ideas is the history of wrongness. I mean, when you look over the continuum of time, people are just constantly wrong about the way that they think the world is. And, you know, people have died believing things with all, you know, smart people have died believing things that later prove to be false. So a lot of these things, when you say the evidence seems, you know, irrefutable, I mean, you seem, I've talked to you, never actually, you've said one thing to me, right? You seem like a smart guy though, you're sitting in the fourth row, you have a question, you know, you wear glasses, you know, probably a smart guy. But I just would say, you have to realize that the things that seem irrefutable to you may seem irrefutable to you, but that doesn't make them irrefutable. And right now I can just say you're looking at me, you're like, what about like math and stuff like that? Well, that's an interesting thing, you know? Like, I don't know if you're a sports fan, but this is actually a real central thing in the world of sports now. The fact that when I was a little kid, I used to drive me crazy that everybody on TV, everybody in the newspapers, my dad, seemed to discount statistics in favor of things like grit. And like, who wants it more and stuff like that. And I would always be like, the reality of sports, I think, can be understood through like getting USA Today on Tuesday when they run all the basketball stats and just going through the columns. But now that has totally reversed itself. Now we've went all the way over to the other side. And it's only, now to have a conversation about sports, the assumption is that you're really having a conversation about math and that a good sports conversation means you're proving something, which really kind of contradicts the whole reason we like sports. We like sports because we don't know what's going to happen. The goal of the analytic community now seems to be to predict everything before it happens and to never be surprised and to do it in kind of a hectoring way. And I just think that's a real, like I'm not happy about that. But then again, I'm not happy about it because I'm kind of old now. I mean, I'm in the middle of my life, but 44 is old in some ways because I really remember the 70s and 80s, and that's the period that I loved in terms of, like, I was a kid and I loved sports. You know, when I wrote this book, now I've been doing lots of media, lots of interviews. The one thing many people ask does this make you pessimistic about the future? Because it seems hopeless to, you know, to say it's hopeless to know if we're right or wrong. Does it make you optimistic, you know? In that there's a sense of wonder and unknowingness about reality. I gotta say, it has kind of made me conclude that the future is neutral. Like, the future is gonna be different, but that's not good or bad. It's just that anything that alters the thing you got used to is gonna be uncomfortable. I mean, that's just a process that's hard to get around. Okay, I was loved metal in the 80s and music in the 80s. You know, that was during a period of cassettes. Vinyl had kind of gotten out, but we all listened to cassettes, you know. And for the longest time, I only had 5 cassettes. I could only afford 5, and I'd listen to these cassettes over and over and over again. And I would hear things in the music that I would never have heard if I hadn't listened to, like, Ozzy's Bark at the Moon 1,000 times. I mean, and that's not an exaggeration. I'm sure I did. I listened to some of those songs 1,000 times. Well, now, music's totally different. It's all file sharing and Spotify, and anybody who's into music has access to every song available. Somehow, to me, I missed the old way. I felt like my experience with music was richer. To a person who didn't experience that, who only hears about it from people my age, a young person who got into music after Napster, they're like, it must have been awful to be trapped in a house with 5 records, you know? You know, and all the things they like about music is different. But it's not like they're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and they're wrong. It's just that it changed. My experience changed, and I was just got used to the way things were. They'll have the same experience when it changes again, you know?
So seeing as how we're in Philadelphia and you wrote a book on wrongness, how do you think Sam Hinkie's The Process will be judged as right or wrong as time changes?
Well, you know, I kind of thought I might get that question. I kind of, you know. Sam Hinkie, in some ways to me, here's my gut reaction. My gut reaction is he's the kind of person who would be like, I like pancakes. Pancakes are good. Must be good to eat 5,000 pancakes. I mean, I like 4 pancakes. Why wouldn't I want 5,000 pancakes? He took an idea that was ignored for too long and just almost it became intertwined with his being. But what he was really doing in a mathematical sense does make sense in this... What he was basically doing was trying to negligibly increase the possibility that the Sixers would get lucky. That's really what it was, that they would be able to get into a situation where they would have a terrible team, be in the lottery, get the first lottery pick, and someone like a LeBron James or a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or something like that, a Larry Bird type, emerged. And it just all kind of lined up, or, you know... And that's what he was doing. It's an interesting philosophy, kind of. It's in some ways, he's really admitting the possibility of wrongness. I know people think he's arrogant and like bullheaded, but what he's really saying is that this is mostly chance. That the way success happens in the NBA is mostly chance. And he was just trying to kind of increase that possibility. But it didn't work. They had bad luck with some injuries. They just kind of sometimes the guys weren't there. The kind of guy they needed wasn't available. And what's weird is that if they end up becoming a good team, if this does work, will he then get credit for it, or will he be a forgotten figure? Like he might be laying the foundation for a good team later, but it also sort of brings this. I mean. No, I'm not going to waste too much, because there's probably some people here who don't care about sports at all. I'm not going to waste too much time on this, but it does raise an interesting question, is that why does a sports franchise exist? Okay. Does it exist so you can win a championship? Is that the only goal? Is anything less than that a failure? Or is sports actually just a certain kind of entertainment, and what you should be doing as a general manager or an owner is to make the team entertaining as possible year to year. That if you like this team, you're always sort of interested in this. Whereas now if you like the Sixers, you had to have been almost hoping they would lose games. Because there was no way they were going to win enough games to make the playoffs. So it was like the only possibility was to lose, lose, lose. I think that's a weird position to put people in. And it seems to exaggerate the meaning of a championship. In a way that just, when you really think about it, I mean, like, I've said this before, and I love sports. I mean, everybody knows this, but every game is an exhibition. Like, we watch preseason football, and it's like, nobody cares. These are exhibitions. They're all exhibitions. The Super Bowl is an exhibition. Nothing is really at stake. It's not like a gladiator fight where we're going to kill the team who loses. The rules are made up. We made them up. It's all this fake thing. You know? So.
I'm just curious what your suggestion would be for curriculum planning up until college.
Wow. Now, that is not a question I anticipated. I'll tell you what, I get asked a lot of questions. I have never been asked that. Okay, wow, that's a great question. Well, I now have a 2-year-old kid and a 4-month-old kid, so I have thought about these things because, okay, this is bragging, but like, my 2-year-old seems pretty smart. I mean, I know every parent thinks that, but I see him with the other kids at the little preschool, and it's Brooklyn where there's tons of smart kids, and it's like him and another girl there are smart, okay? So in a way, I feel good about this, right? I feel great that this is happening. In another sense, I've been told by people that no matter how much your kid is ahead or behind, unless they're at the real extreme poles, in third grade, it all kind of evens out again, and you're like hitting reset, which kind of makes me think, some of these books I'm reading him are boring. Like, you know, it's like if he's not going to learn about, you know, these dinosaurs, I might as well just go on. But, I mean, I like many people, I'm of the belief that the thing you want to teach someone is critical thinking. That is what's important. It doesn't matter what you go into, a critical thinking person is a smart person, okay? The question becomes, how do you really teach that? Because you can be a critical thinker and come up with the wrong kind of conclusions which don't translate into successful testing. And now testing seems to be so important. I read a book where a guy, his kid was smart but like struggling in school. And the kid was like 16. And the guy said, you know what? You can quit school. But here's what you got to do. Every day, you have to watch a movie, and I'm going to tell you what movie to watch, and you got to tell me about that movie. And the kid ended up becoming really smart. So I think there are ways that you can sort of generate this kind of outside the traditional education system, but who wants to take that gamble? Like, even though I just gave that example, I would never do it. I would never be like, oh, yeah, hey, don't worry, we'll just... You can see, you know, Glengarry Glen Ross, and you'll figure. It's like, I was like, so I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing you're a teacher. Yeah, but you know more than me. I can't give a. And also, everything has changed. Like, math has changed, I guess. I hear this that the way, like, I have friends who got kids who are a little older, and the way they learn, it's not the way I learn math. But then at this preschool, they're back into phonics, which I thought was done. You know, there's a part in this book where I talk about the idea of rote memorization. In his autobiography, Bob Dylan talks about, kind of casually but kind of abstractly, but why he would like record long songs like Tom Joad that has 16 verses. And he came, you know, he was born much, you know, in like 1940 or whatever. He grew up in a time when rote memorization was a big thing in school, and he says it's just enriching to memorize things. That there's just something that's intellectually enriching about having to memorize complicated things. Now, with the time I went to school in the 80s, that was kind of disappeared. I mean, I had to memorize the Gettysburg Address, the preamble, and because I was Catholic, many prayers. But that was it. The idea of rote memorization was less. I think it's completely gone now. And in fact, I don't think if you use the term rote memorization, I think people would hear that like corporal punishment or something. Like, they just, you know... But I wonder if maybe there is a value to just memorizing things because, you know, what is the size of your reality? The size of your reality is the size of your memory. And things like the internet allow us not to use memory. It allows us to be like, well, we don't really have to learn about these things because we can instantly access them. And it gives us a shallow understanding, but not really the depth of understanding that forcing yourself to basically put things in order and remember it and sort of having to make up mnemonic devices. So I wonder if that will come around, if one day there'll be a realization that we shouldn't have gotten away from rote memorization, but... I don't know. It's too good of a question for me to answer. Yeah.
Thanks. You think about today, contemporary time, and you compare it to previous times, 16th century. And some of these previous times have labels, the Renaissance, Enlightenment, so forth. I'm curious about two things. One would be, what's your opinion about what date did our era start? And what would you call this era? What do you think that these future people are going to call this era? Is it the age of computers or the age of stupid opinions?
Yeah.
And well, by the way, I'm available for voiceover.
Oh. first of all, very good question. Okay. Part of it has to do with how far we get from this time. Okay. If we say get 50 years from now, we probably say this is the age of the internet. I mean, that's certainly the most transformative thing that has happened since the advent of television, and in many ways, much more transformative because, while television is sort of more something that we use to escape from life, the internet is now interlocked with life. And, you know, I often feel very alienated from technology, and yet I can't do anything without it, and I know that I'm not alone in this. This is a very common thing. So I think in the short term, just the advent of the internet, and particularly sort of its dovetailing with everyone's day-to-day experience. However, if we get further and further away from that, I think that answer changes. If you get far enough away, I think our era, you know, it's like, when does our era begin? I think for a lot of people in a distant future, it will be after World War II. And the thing that will really matter is that after World War II, there was the invention of the teenager. Now, obviously, there had always been people who were 13 or 15. That's always been the case. But prior to World War II, for the most part, you were a child until you got a job or got married, and then you were an adult, even if that happened when you were 11. Like, that's how it was, okay? But after World War II, we kind of invented the notion of this period in life in between being a child and an adult. It had to do with the advent of cars sort of being more accessible. People, teenagers could go off by themselves. But the big thing was that suddenly we had art that was specifically geared toward that demographic, even though they would have never used that word. Rock music being the clear example of this. Okay, rock music is important for no other reason than it's the first art form that exists only with the idea that it's representing kind of the mores and sensibilities of a teenager. And what has happened, and I don't know why, but it just has, that sort of experience, the culture that comes with that experience, has become sort of the mainstream culture. I mean, the biggest artists in the world right now are like Kanye and Beyonce and Taylor Swift, who are fundamentally making their material for people who are teenagers. It's enjoyed by a much larger swath, and sort of the backbone of their success, you know, fiscally, is kind of paid for by people in their 30s and 40s. But the art form is for them, really. It's for young people. And I wonder if this era's thing will be that this is when the idea of culture moved from something kind of an elite, informed adult was into to what was interesting to young people. And I think that would be my answer.
When I got the Sunday New York Times magazine, one of the first things I looked at was your column, The Ethicist.
Thank you.
And I'm really happy to see you, not in silhouette. But
still fat, though.
Well, yeah.
I'm still fat. Okay.
Anyway, I thought that you were giving the kind of, in the answers there, collective rightness or the collective legal rightness of the culture to the as answers. And I'm wondering how you square that with your book now, you know, in terms of looking at different ways of that kind of thing.
Okay, what he's asking about is I had a column at the New York Times for about 3 years called The Ethicist. I wasn't the inventor of this column. I took the column over. I guess I always kind of thought this was an insulting way to describe it, but I guess it's kind of true. It was kind of like a Dear Abby column, but for kind of serious ethical problems. People would write problems from their own life And then I would sort of talk about the like the morality of what is, regardless of what decision the writer was going to make, because most of the time the decision had ever happened before it ran. Like, you know, they'd have the problem, they'd write it in, I'd get it, weeks would pass, it would get selected, I'd think about it for a week, it would run in the magazine. It was like in the past, but I was trying to make it appeal to, you know, other people's. Could they look at this problem and say, I relate to it? Well, first of all, being the ethicist was a really fun thing, but it was disappointing because I thought I'd be great at it, and I was only okay, and that really disappointed me. I really thought I'd be great at it. I thought that maybe in some ways a lot of what I had done in the past was building toward this, but I was just okay. It was such a difficult job if you took it seriously. I mean, the people who had had it before me, particularly the guy who invented it, Randy Cohen, he had been a writer for David Letterman. He used it as a humor column. He was smart in it. It wasn't just funny, but his main thing was like he wanted to be entertaining. And I knew that when I took the job, people would assume because of my past that I would do the same. But I wanted to go the other way. I wanted to do it in a more sort of serious, real way. When you're dealing with these ethical problems, the more you think about them, the harder they become. Plus, I wasn't going to pick obvious questions, even though weirdly the readers seemed to like that. Like, the things that the readers liked was when somebody would write in like, hey, is it okay if I steal from my daughter? And then if I was like, no, you're a terrible person, they'd be like, that's great, you know, real self-righteous. It was a bizarre thing. People just want to see people yelled at, you know? But I was always consciously picking questions that really could go either way. And while I love thinking about it, I just worried about this constantly. The risk and the reward did not seem to match up. The risk seemed to be every week I could write the wrong thing and end my career. Like, we live in a very volatile time, and you're dealing with questions about identity politics and things like that. You know, I was like, any single week could be the end of my life. The upside was like somebody would read it and be like, he was okay this week. Like, that seemed to be the best that would happen. Somebody would be like, oh, hey, you did all right with that. But the worst thing is that my life was done. And it just made me feel bad all the time. So when a new editor came in, he was like, I'm thinking of going with a new direction. I was like, great. Like, let's just, you know, let's end this relationship. I'll just chalk this up as something that I did and kind of failed at. But I do think it helped, it made me a better writer for two reasons. One, you know, when you write for the Times, there's all these obstructions. There's words you can't use, and I don't mean like profanity. There's just their style book is just crazy. And I had a very limited amount of space, and I was dealing with problems. You know, like, when I was a rock critic, and I was, say, reviewing, like, a record by Drake or whatever, and they'd say, oh, you have another 100 words, I'll be like, oh, I'll just add some jokes. Or they'll be like, you're 100 words over, and I'll be like, I'll take some jokes out. But if somebody's asking me about their grandma with Alzheimer's and, like, how to deal with her sense of, like, being, I was like, I can't just fluff it out, you know. It's got to be perfect. It's got to be perfect. This is a real serious thing. So that made me a better writer. And also, it just made me more thoughtful about sort of the idea behind ideas. That there's, you know, there's always a superficial meaning to something, and it's very easy to sort of look at that superficial answer and kind of almost go with the consensus, the cultural consensus. How do most people feel about this? As if ethics are something that we just kind of agree on, which to some extent is true. I mean, you know, like, morality, in theory, should be the same for everyone all the time, where ethics are kind of a framework that society works out. And that's, you know, so you're always dealing with two things that are in some ways extremely, extremely similar, and in another way, very, very different. I don't know if I answered your question at all, but that's my memory of that experience. Yeah.
It seems like if you take the philosophy of what you're talking about to heart, you'd have analysis paralysis and never decide on anything. It seems like we all really need to be naive, observationist, in order to really get from day to day. How do you address that?
Well, here's what I would say. Like, you're saying you'd be paralyzed because you will never really know, will never be certain. All I'm hoping for is that people will make the same arguments they make and just remove that last aspect of being certain. I mean, I just think that it would be so valuable in a social context if people were just a little more willing to admit that in all likelihood what they believe, regardless of how sound it seems, there is a strong possibility that as people move on, as time moves on, values will change. Our idea of importance will change. So that thing that they believe is so right is actually temporary. You know, it's like that these things are just more temporary. I'm not trying to like I know it, the way I write, the style in which I write does seem persuasive. I mean, there's a persuasive style to it, but that's just kind of the style I use. I'm never hoping that people think like me. That's never been my goal. When I was a critic, I never wanted to be a tastemaker. I never wanted to, you know, to convince people, listen to this record, don't listen to this record. I might say that, but I didn't really care if they believed me. I was doing it for myself in a way. Like, I enjoy the process, and I want people to enjoy reading. I don't care what they do when they're done reading. So maybe this is just kind of playing into my bias. I don't know. But I don't, it's not a problem for me. Like the idea that you know, I've made a lot of bold, bombastic statements in other books that maybe even already I look back on and I'll be like, I disagree with that. I shouldn't have did that. But I had to be true at the time, you know? You just got to be true in the time, you know?
I'm curious about the character from Visible Man. His name was Y, and then it underscores. My guess is that a reference to Generation Y, or is it, you know, endless scientifically asking questions, like always ask why, or is it just like a secret name that you don't want to share?
Okay, he's asking about my second novel, The Visible Man. There's a character who's only known as Y. That's the only thing, you know, the letter Y. Couple things. And there's actually a joke in this book, I think, in the book where I kind of I love the idea of a character who's singularly described as a letter, because I think that when you remove the name of someone, the natural inclination of the writer is then to sort of create in their mind a person with unspecific ideals. That even if you just call the guy Yancey, they're like, oh, well, it's a person named Yancey. But by giving him just the letter Y, it's almost though it's some kind of signal that this person is not supposed to represent an individual, but a kind, a type of individual. I really like Alfred Hitchcock films, because Alfred Hitchcock doesn't necessarily use characters as much as types of characters. Why, as a question, also, that's a good point. I mean, that's kind of maybe too on the nose, actually, that why also represents the word why. But also, it's like, it's hard to find letters that haven't been used. Like, K was in Kafka, and like, M was in a bunch of French novels. Like, it was, I think initially, the letter was M. And then somebody was like, oh, is this some reference to like French novel? I was like, no, so I better change it, you know?
Yeah. I'm interested in knowing what you have to say about Donald Trump.
Well, you know, a couple things. People didn't take him seriously. They didn't take him seriously. How long will this go on? Oh, don't worry about it. We don't take him seriously. All of a sudden, he gets the nomination, and all the people who didn't take him seriously hit the panic button immediately. They went from not taking him seriously to saying, this is going to destroy democracy. Now, what is interesting is that this happened because of democracy. Like, we live in a world where anyone can be president, where you can vote for whoever you want. You can support somebody regardless of their qualifications. So I think it's interesting when people say that Donald Trump threatens democracy. Donald Trump is actually the extension of what the risk of democracy is. Obviously, he would be a terrible president. I mean, there's like there's no... But that said, I foresee this possibility. First of all, I don't think he can win mathematically because, you know, granted, saying that's a risk because so many other things that have happened make no sense, you know, but it would seem like Obama won both elections, not in a landslide, but pretty decisively, and it would mean that either a bunch of people who have never voted in the last 25 years would suddenly come out to vote specifically for Trump, or some of the people who voted for Obama will now vote for Trump. And it's hard to imagine why that would happen. I mean, I just can't see. I can't imagine the person who was like, I loved Obama, but no way am I going with Hillary. I'm going, that's not, it's beyond sexism. I don't even know what that would be. That would, that's a weird thing, you know? But let's say he does. Let's say he wins Florida by a narrow margin, and let's say a lot of people in Ohio who haven't voted before come out and vote. He wins Ohio by the narrowest of margins. He's the president. Maybe he wins a state, some state that had traditionally been a Democratic state, but for whatever reason, he appeals to a segment of that populace that is usually underserved, and Trump is president. I think the real likelihood is that he would just be a terrible president in the way presidents are traditionally terrible. I mean, he'd spend 2 years trying to build a wall that will never exist. He has no ideology. It would take him a year to figure out what his ideology is. I mean, guys like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, they're like, we're going to get into office and change the world on the first day. It's like Trump's like, hey, I have a golf course. He's like, no. He'd have no support from either house in Congress. His overall popularity, his approval rating, would never get above 33%. He'd be the least popular president ever. I mean, that's going to happen regardless. There's never been a presidential race where both candidates are so unpopular. But, I mean, his unpopularity is off the scale. He would probably do, in the first 6 months, 3 or 4 things that would at least warrant a conversation for impeachment. Well, I don't even think that's funny. I mean, there were people who wanted to impeach Obama, and they did impeach Clinton. I mean, that's like there are people who wanted to impeach, Bush and all these things. That would almost certainly happen. I wouldn't say he'd be impeached, but that would always be on the table. Other countries would think we're idiots, but that's already the case in a lot of ways. I mean, it just is. I lived in Germany for a while. I was shocked by how dumb they think Americans are. I mean, well, you're like, yay. It's like, we're idiots. Yeah, I was hanging out with some German professors, and I said, let's rank the other countries, because Germans do that. They kind of think we're the best country, And I was like, what's the next best country? And they're like, oh, France, they're the most intellectual country. And then what's next? And they'd be like, oh, maybe Russia because of their history of novels and novels. And I was like, okay, who's third? And they were like, well, maybe the UK. And I was like, well, where does America come in? And they're like, you're like Australia. You like sports a lot. You're really loud and you're drunk in public. I was like, well, that's an interesting way to look at America. Also, in some ways, they did get some things wrong. I was teaching a class on 20th century American popular culture. On the very first day of class, a grad student is walking along with me, and he's asking me, and I tell him I'm teaching this class on 20th century American popular culture. And he's like, oh, that should take 20 minutes. And I was like, well, funny, kind of, because I'm the only American there, I kind of got to be like, oh, yeah, we're idiots or whatever. But, of course, all the kids in my class love hip-hop. They're obsessed with hip-hop. So I'm like, this is American popular culture. And one kid said, oh, that's an immigrant culture. And I was like, not if you bring slaves. It's like, that's not an immigrant. That's not how you describe an immigrant culture. It's like, that was something that sort of emerged from the reality of the weirdness of America. Like, the problematic nature of America's history caused this to happen. That's how much culture is created. But they don't want to think that way, right? So it doesn't matter if Trump is president or Trump's not. A certain percentage of Europe is going to think we're idiots, okay? Now, people say, well, can we trust Trump with the nuclear codes? It's like, he's not going to start a nuclear war. It's like, he'd be like, it's bad for business. People will not buy, jackets if they can't, get away from radiation or whatever. First of all, some of the things he says probably are true. I bet Putin would like him more. Like, Putin doesn't respect Obama at all because he's like, this guy's smart. We should kill him, But, he and Donald Trump probably would get along. I don't know what the upshot would be. We're going to start trading more with Russia, I guess. That's sort of my, I guess this would be what they call a hot take now. It's that Trump might just be a normal bad president, okay?
Led Zeppelin being sued in federal court right now for copyright infringement. I wonder, have you heard the song that's alleged to have taken place before that? Do you think that they copied that song? And then also, you've interviewed Robert Plant, I believe.
Oh, Jimmy Page. Both.
Okay, what do you think they're thinking right now?
Okay, well, the song, the band is called Taurus, right? Yeah, and the I have heard the song. Spirit, the song is Taurus. The band is Spirit, you're right, okay. First of all, that's the beginning of that song sounds exactly like Stairway to Heaven. And the guys in the band, the guys in Spirit, they opened for Led Zeppelin, and supposedly Jimmy Page came backstage one time and said, like, I don't really like your music except that one song. Now, maybe the guys in Spirit are lying, but it's not like Led Zeppelin doesn't have a history of doing this. Like, they have many, many songs that they use. Jimmy Page just wouldn't talk about it. He was just like, he wasn't the easiest interview in the world. I loved interviewing him. I mean, I love Led Zeppelin. It was, to me, interviewing Jimmy Page in England, that is something I would have never imagined would have happened in my life. And I don't get starstruck. And I wasn't starstruck, but I was like, this is great. This is great that this happened. He wouldn't really talk about it. And his answer is always like, I've already talked about it, even though he never has, really. The lawsuit itself is a complicated thing because you can't really quantify the value of the song Stairway to Heaven. Like, I don't know what, when something sort of transcends its role as a popular song, like, to say it's worth $1 billion is in no way an exaggeration, because it's worth it. There are people who are not yet born who will get into Led Zeppelin based on hearing about other people who like the song Stairway to Heaven. I mean, like, this is, you know. I think what they'll do is they'll eventually just settle because, I mean, the guys in Led Zeppelin are incredibly rich. I mean, incredibly, incredibly rich. And the thing is, though, unlike a lot of American artists, like, you wouldn't really know it. Like, they don't live in they don't act in a, like, David Lee Roth. I interviewed him, and one of his things was like, it's not how much money you make, it's how much money you spend. That's what he told me. He's like, he didn't care how much money anyone made, he only wanted to know how much money they had spent. Jimmy Page is not like that. Jimmy Page is like, I'm not tipping the taxi driver. Like, he is cheap. They are cheap guys, you know? But they'll settle. They'll settle. And the fact of the matter is, it's like, if I was Led Zeppelin's lawyer, what I would argue is that, you know what, Spirit, if they stole this song, that's the only important thing you have given to music, really. I mean, the fact that I got their name wrong, like, I'm not the genius, but, like, I follow this stuff pretty closely, and I transposed the song and the band. I mean, like, that kind of reflects sort of the impact Spirit has had on the musical culture. So this is a real meaningful thing. If Jimmy Page, like, I think the guys in Spirit, if Jimmy Page just said, like, you know what, I probably unconsciously copied it. I didn't mean to, but I kind of did. Must be a good song. Like the chord progression. We're going to give them an undisclosed sum, you know, and that would be like an island probably or whatever, you know. I think the guys in Spirit would be like, that's great. He's just admitting this happened. Because when, like Willie Dixon, like, his estate, when they took, they just kind of wanted Led Zeppelin to say, like, we did this. So maybe that is the conclusion. But the songs do sound similar. If you haven't listened to the song Taurus by Spirit, you can listen to it on Spotify or whatever. It's like, I will be surprised if anyone here is like, I don't see the connection. You will see the connection. Okay, well, hey, you were a great audience. Really good questions. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.